Chapter 6. Into the irrevocable past off the toes of all Europe. How fatal to the parvenu, throughout history, has been this respect for shoebuckles. Where, for instance, would the empire of Napoleon have been, if Neand lands had never sported such a thing as a coat of arms, and had only written their simple names on their shields, after the fashion of Desaix's escutcheon yonder, the bold republican who led the crowning charge at Marengo, and sent the best blood of the Holy Roman Empire to the right about, before the wretched misbegotten imperial heraldry was born, that was to prove, so disastrous to the father of it. It has always been so. They won't amalgamate. A country must be governed by the one principle or the other. But give, in a republic, an aristocracy ever so little chance, and it works and plots and sneaks and bullies, and sneers itself into place, and you find democracy out of doors. Is it good that the aristocracy should so triumph? That is a question that you may settle according to your own notions and taste. And permit me to say, I do not care twopence how you settle it. Large books have been written upon the subject in a variety of languages, and coming to a variety of conclusions. Great statesmen are there in our country, from Lord Londonderry down to Mr. Vincent, each in his degree maintaining his different opinion. But here, in the matter of Napoleon, is a simple fact. He founded a great, glorious, strong, potent republic, able to cope with the best aristocracies in the world, and perhaps to beat them all. He converts his republic into a monarchy, and surrounds his monarchy with what he calls aristocratic institutions. And you know what becomes of him. The people estranged, the aristocracy faithless, when did they ever pardon one who was not of themselves? The imperial fabric tumbles to the ground. If it teaches nothing else, my dear, it teaches one a great point of policy, namely, to stick by one's party. While these thoughts and sundry others relative to the horrible cold of the place, the intense dullness of delay, the stupidity of leaving a warm bed, and a breakfast in order to witness a procession, that is much better performed at a theater, while these thoughts were passing in the mind, the church began to fill apace, and you saw that the hour of the ceremony was drawing near. Imprimis. Came men with lighted staves, and set fire to at least 10,000 wax candles that were hanging in brilliant chandeliers in various parts of the chapel. Curtains were dropped over the upper windows as these illuminations were effected, and the church was left only to the funereal light of the spermaceti. To the right was the dome, round the cavity of which sparkling lamps were set, that designed the shape of it brilliantly against the darkness. In the midst, and where the altar used to stand, rose the catafalque. And why not? Who is God here but Napoleon? And in him the skeptics have already ceased to believe. But the people does still somewhat. He and Louis XIV. Divide the worship of the place between them. As for the catafalque, the best that I can say for it is that it is really a noble and imposing-looking edifice, with tall pillars supporting a grand dome, with innumerable escutcheons, standards, and illusions military and funereal. A great eagle of course tops the whole. Tripods burning spirits of wine stand round this kind of dead man's throne, and as we saw it by peering over the heads of our neighbors, in the front rank, it looked, in the midst of the black concave, and under the effect of half a thousand flashing cross lights, properly grand and tall. The effect of the whole chapel, however, to speak the jargon of the painting room, was spoiled by being cut up. There were too many objects for the eye to rest upon. The 10,000 wax candles, for instance, in their numberless twinkling chandeliers, the raw transient colors of the new banners, wreaths, bees, ends, and other emblems dotting the place all over, and incessantly puzzling, or rather bothering the beholder. High overhead, in a sort of mist, with the glare of their original colors worn down by dust and time, hung long rows of dim ghostly-looking standards, captured in old days from the enemy. They were, I thought, the best and most solemn part of the show. To suppose that the people were bound, to be solemn during the ceremony is to exact from them something quite needless and unnatural. The very fact of a squeeze dissipates all solemnity. One great crowd is always, as I imagine, pretty much like another. In the course of the last few years I have seen three. That attending the coronation of our present sovereign, that which went to see Courvoisier hanged, and this which witnessed the Napoleon ceremony. The people so assembled for hours together are jocular rather than solemn, seeking to pass away the weary time with the best amusements that will offer. There was, to be sure, in all the scenes above alluded to, just one moment, one particular moment, when the universal people feels a shock, and is for that second serious. But except for that second of time, I declare I saw no seriousness here beyond that of ennui. The church began to fill with personages of all ranks and conditions. First, opposite our seats came a company of fat grenadiers of the National Guard, who presently, at the word of command, put their muskets down against benches and wainscots, until the arrival of the procession. For 7 hours these men formed the object of the most anxious solicitude of all the ladies and gentlemen seated on our benches. They began to stamp their feet, for the cold was atrocious, and we were frozen where we sat. Some of them fell to blowing their fingers. One executed a kind of dance, such as one sees often here in cold weather. The individual jumps repeatedly upon one leg, and kicks out the other violently, meanwhile his hands are flapping across his chest. Some fellows opened their cartridge boxes, and from them drew eatables of various kinds. You can't think how anxious we were to know the qualities of the same. Ions, C. Gros Kui Main June Custival Ale. L.A. Du Jambon, Celu I La. Should like some too, growls an Englishman, for I hadn't a morsel of breakfast, and so on. This is the way, my dear, that we see Napoleon buried. Did you ever see a chicken escape from clown in a pantomime, and hop over into the pit, or amongst the fiddlers? And have you not seen the shrieks of enthusiastic laughter that the wondrous incident occasions? We had our chicken, of course. There never was a public crowd without one. A poor unhappy woman in a greasy plaid cloak, with a battered rose-colored plush bonnet, was seen taking her place among the stalls allotted to the grandees. Oyez donc l'Anglais, said everybody, and it was too true. You could swear that the wretch was an Englishwoman. A bonnet was never made or worn so in any other country. Half an hour's delightful amusement did this lady give us all. She was whisked from seat to seat by the hussiers, and at every change of place woke a peal of laughter. I was glad, however, at the end of the day, to see the old pink bonnet over a very comfortable seat, which somebody had not claimed, and she had kept. Are not these remarkable incidents? The next wonder we saw was the arrival of a set of tottering old invalids, who took their places under us with drawn sabers. Then came a superb drum major, a handsome, smiling, good-humored giant of a man, his breeches astonishingly embroidered with silver lace. Him a dozen little drummer boys followed, the little darlings. All the ladies cried out in a breath. They were indeed pretty little fellows, and came and stood close under us. The huge drum major smiled over his little red-capped flock, and for many hours in the most perfect contentment twiddled his mustaches, and played with the tassels of his cane. Now the company began to arrive thicker and thicker. A whole covey of consailors dedit came in blue coats, embroidered with blue silk. Then came a crowd of lawyers in toques and caps, among whom were sundry venerable judges in scarlet, purple velvet, and ermine, a kind of bajazet costume. Look there. There is the Turkish ambassador in his red cap, turning his solemn brown face about and looking preternaturally wise. The deputies walk in a body. Gizet is not there. He passed by just now in full ministerial costume. Presently little Fear saunters back. What a clear, broad, sharp-eyed face the fellow has, with his gray hair cut down so demure. A servant passes, pushing through the crowd a shabby wheelchair. It has just brought old Monsey, the governor of the invalids, the honest old man who defended Paris so stoutly in 1814. He has been very ill, and is worn down almost by infirmities. But in his illness he was perpetually asking, "Doctor, shall I live till the 15th? Give me till then, and I die contented." One can't help believing that the old man's wish is honest, however one may doubt the piety of another illustrious marshal, who once carried a candle before Charles X, in a procession, and has been this morning to Neuilly, to kneel and pray at the foot of Napoleon's coffin. He might have said his prayers at home, to be sure, but don't let us ask too much. That kind of reserve is not a Frenchman's characteristic. Bang, bang! At about 2:30, a dull sound of cannonading was heard without the church, and signals took place between the commandant of the invalids, of the National Guards, and the big drum major. Looking to these troops, the fat nationals were shuffling into line again. The two commandants tittered, as nearly as I could catch them, the following words, "Harum hump." At once all the national bayonets were on the present, and the sabers of the old invalids up. The big drum major looked round at the children, who began very slowly and solemnly on their drums, rub-dub-dub, rub-dub-dub, count two between each, rub-dub-dub, and a great procession of priests came down from the altar. First, there was a tall handsome cross-bearer, bearing a long gold cross, of which the front was turned towards His Grace the Archbishop. Then came a double row of about 16 innocent boys, dressed in white surplices. The first boy, about 6 years old, the last with whiskers, and of the height of a man. Then followed a regiment of priests in black tippets and white gowns. They had black hoods, like the moon when she is at her third quarter, wherewith those who were bald many were, and fat too, covered themselves. All the reverend men held their heads meekly down, and affected to be reading in their breviaries. After the priests came some bishops of the neighboring districts, in purple, with crosses sparkling on their episcopal bosoms. Then came, after more priests, a set of men whom I have never seen before, a kind of ghostly heralds, young and handsome men, some of them in stiff tabards of black and silver, their eyes to the ground, their hands placed at right angles with their chests. Then came two gentlemen bearing remarkable tall candlesticks, with candles of corresponding size. One was burning brightly, but the wind that chartered Liberton had blown out the other, which nevertheless kept its place in the procession. I wondered to myself whether the reverend gentleman who carried the extinguished candle felt disgusted, humiliated, mortified, perfectly conscious that the eyes of many thousands of people were bent upon that bit of refractory wax. We all of us looked at it with intense interest. Another cross-bearer, behind whom came a gentleman carrying an instrument like a bedroom candlestick. His grandeur, Monseigneur Affer, Archbishop of Paris. He was in black and white, his eyes were cast to the earth, his hands were together at right angles from his chest. On his hands were black gloves, and on the black gloves sparkled the sacred episcopal, what do I say? Archiepiscopal ring. On his head was the mitre. It is unlike the godly coronet that figures upon the coach panels of our own right reverend bench. The archbishop's mitre may be about a yard high. Formed within probably of consecrated pasteboard, it is without covered by a sort of watered silk of white and silver. On the two peaks at the top of the mitre are two very little spangled tassels that frisk and twinkle about in a very agreeable manner. Monseigneur stood opposite to us for some time, when I had the opportunity to note the above remarkable phenomena. He stood opposite me for some time, keeping his eyes steadily on the ground, his hands before him, a small clerical train following after. Why didn't they move? There was the National Guard keeping on presenting arms, the little drummers going on rub-dub-dub, rub-dub-dub in the same steady, slow way, and the procession never moved an inch. There was evidently, to use an elegant phrase, a hitch somewhere. Enter a fat priest who bustles up to the drum major. Fat priest, aces vows. Little drummer rub dub dub rub dub dub rub dub dub. And C drum major oost C dong. Fat priestesses vows. Dis G. C nest pause la cor. Il the river pause por un hour. The little drums were instantly hushed. The procession turned to the right about and walked back to the altar again. The blown out candle that had been on the near side of us before was now on the off side. The National Guard set down their muskets and began at their sandwiches again. We had to wait an hour and a half at least before the great procession arrived. The guns without went on booming all the while at intervals, and as we heard each, the audience gave a kind of ha-ha, such as you hear when the rockets go up at Vauxhall. At last the real procession came. Then the drums began to beat as formerly, the nationals to get under arms, the clergymen were sent for and went, and presently yes, there was the tall cross-bearer at the head of the procession, and they came back. They chanted something in a weak, snuffling, lugubrious manner, to the melancholy bray of a serpent. Crash! However, Mr. Habneck and the fiddlers in the organ loft pealed out a wild shrill march, which stopped the reverend gentleman, and in the midst of this music, and of a great trampling of feet and clattering, and of a great crowd of generals and officers in fine clothes, with the Prince de Joinville marching quickly at the head of the procession, and while everybody's heart was thumping as hard as possible, Napoleon's coffin passed. It was done in an instant. A box covered with a great red cross, a dingy-looking crown lying on the top of it, seamen on one side and invalids on the other, they had passed in an instant, and were up the aisle. A faint snuffling sound, as before, was heard from the officiating priests, but we knew of nothing more. It is said that old Louis-Philippe was standing at the catafalque, whither the Prince de Joinville advanced and said, "Sire, I bring you the body of the Emperor Napoleon." Louis-Philippe answered, "I receive it in the name of France." Bertrand put on the body the most glorious victorious sword that ever has been forged since the apt descendants of the first murderer learned how to hammer steel, and the coffin was placed in the temple prepared for it. The 600 singers and the fiddlers now commenced the playing and singing of a piece of music, and a part of the crew of the Belle Powell skipped into the places that had been kept for them under us, and listened to the music, chewing tobacco. While the actors and fiddlers were going on, most of the spirits of wine lamps on altars went out. When we arrived in the open air, we passed through the court of the invalids, where thousands of people had been assembled, but where the benches were now quite bare. Then we came onto the terrace before the place. The old soldiers were firing off the great guns, which made a dreadful stunning noise, and frightened some of us, who did not care to pass before the cannon, and be knocked down even by Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.